From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. A new report from the Iowa Hospital Association finds the state's community hospitals generate some 150,000 jobs that add over $1 billion to Iowa's economy. This hour, we examine the economics of Iowa's hospitals. Specifically, with hospitals being a huge economic driver for many Iowa communities, what is the economic development aspect of healthcare reform? My guests will include the president and CEO of the Iowa Hospital Association, Kirk Norris, also Joe LaValle of Mercy Medical Center, Des Moines, and Kenneth Fisher of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. The role of hospitals in our economy and how that may be changed by healthcare reform. First, a look at this hour's news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A new report from the Iowa Hospital Association finds the state's community hospitals generate some 150,000 jobs that add over $1 billion to Iowa's economy. So we want to take the hour to examine the economics of Iowa's hospitals, also in light of the hospitals in our economy and how they may be changed by health care reform. Also, what part should hospitals play in health care reform and in reducing health care costs? What can our hospitals do to improve healthcare while reducing costs? A couple of the questions we'll be looking at this hour with my guests joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Kirk Norris, he is president and CEO of the Iowa Hospital Association. Good afternoon to you, Kirk.
Good afternoon.
Also joining us from Des Moines, Joe LaValle, senior vice president of planning and advocacy at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. Good afternoon, Joe.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you from our studios in Iowa City. Kenneth Fisher is joining us. He is Associate Vice President and CFO for the University of Iowa Healthcare. Good afternoon to you, Kenneth.
Good afternoon.
Let's start with you, Kirk, if we can. Give us a snapshot of the state's hospitals. The Iowa Hospital Association represents all Iowa hospitals?
That's correct. There's 118 hospitals in Iowa, and they are all members of our voluntary association. The hospitals are comprised of about equal halves of private, nonprofit, and or publicly governed. In other words, the half that's publicly governed would have trustees that are elected at the local level, either at the county level or at the municipal or city level.
So what are the main points the Iowa Hospital Association wants to bring out, is bringing out in this report detailing the economic impact of Iowa's hospitals?
Well, we've done this report for several years, and the main point that we'd like to bring out is that healthcare is not one-dimensional. Oftentimes in policy discussions, the discussion revolves around healthcare costs and increasing healthcare costs, and folks don't really stop to take a look at the value of healthcare in their community. In Iowa, we're blessed because folks do consider this factor. And years ago, we started using a model that was created by the federal government and is actually populated by data from the American Hospital Association Annual Survey, the Iowa Department of Public Revenue and Finance, and the U.S. Census Bureau and the Bureau of Economic Analysis to try to put a number to the existence of not just hospitals, but physicians and dentists and other practitioners, as well as nursing and residential care and pharmacies, all of which, you know, you find throughout Iowa and are kind of a foundation to the local economic infrastructure. So it's really to get folks to look beyond the service and access perspectives and look at it from an economic perspective, which is important when you're talking about the growth and development of Iowa.
It sounds to me like you're saying there's not the adequate appreciation for the economic impact, a lack of awareness. Is that true?
I don't think there's a lack of a general awareness by Iowans, because when you talk to folks about their community hospitals, they'll quickly connect with the value of having a hospital in their community. It's really helping them quantify what's there. Mm-hmm. And so these models really quantify what's there.
Kirk Norris, what are the biggest challenges facing Iowa's hospitals, the biggest threats in the near future?
Well, the biggest threats are really resources, and that comes in two forms. One, reimbursement for the things that they do, the services that they provide, and from a workforce perspective, maintaining the clinical support that they need to provide the services that they do at the local level. And that involves everything from your allied health professionals to nurses and physicians.
Okay, let's turn to our other two guests to talk. Joe LaValle, also in Des Moines, of Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. Let me pose that to you. What are the biggest challenges, threats, as you see them? Do they match up with what Kirk just outlined?
Yeah, absolutely. Excuse me. The reimbursement challenge is enormous. You know, today Medicaid pays hospitals 30-some cents on the dollar. Medicare last year underpaid Mercy by $26 million. And what I mean by that is when you take the cost of care, what it actually cost Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines to provide care to its Medicare patients, the government paid us $26 million less than what it cost us to provide that care. So these issues of underpayment by the government payers are huge, and it's tough on the area businesses and Iowa's businesses because they're forced to make up that shortfall in their premiums that they pay to private insurance. And as we all know, that there's tremendous efforts to reduce those costs or keep those premiums under control. And so that adds to the pressure at the hospital level. There's a huge number of things being done in an effort to reduce healthcare costs, and we may get into some of that later in the discussion. But certainly that economic resource is huge. And then the workforce issues, while today I think Iowa's in reasonably good shape, we don't have huge shortfalls of nurses and doctors today. If you look at the demographics, the aging of the baby boomers, and the fact that you have the combination of more people needing care and more providers retiring, we certainly see a real crisis coming down the road.
Kenneth Fisher of the University of Iowa Healthcare, I wonder, I assume you share this concern about underfunding the reimbursement of Medicaid. Can you explain to us, for those not involved with this, how Medicaid is reimbursed, and how does it come to be that it's underfunded, and why, this was not mentioned yet, Iowa consistently ranks near the bottom for Medicaid reimbursement?
Medicaid is driven by a program that was adopted by the federal government in 1966, which was the creation of the Medicare and Medicaid program. It originally was designed to cover its cost. And the cost was defined by a program that was called the cost report, which, you know, long ago has been supplanted by a reimbursement formula that's driven by historical relationships between cost and what the government, in Iowa's case, what the state is willing to put in. Because what happens is you put in a dollar of state dollars, and there's a match against the federal dollars. So to the extent that a state is willing to put money into the program, they can draw funds from the federal side. And what happens in Iowa, we have been unwilling to put a lot of dollars into the state side of the match, so therefore we're getting less dollars from the federal side, and end up with the reimbursement rates that get paid to the providers are reduced because there's less total dollars in the system.
And how does that work itself out for you, Kenneth Fisher, at the University of Iowa Healthcare in paying for a lot of patients that come through your doors?
The state has multiple percentages of, for example, Medicaid. I noticed recently that one of the two major systems that's based out of Des Moines reports publicly that they have about 11% Medicaid. The University of Iowa has about 18 to 19% of our business as Medicaid, and another 9 to 10% that's covered under IowaCare, which is a offshoot of the program. So there are huge differences in the payer relationships and the size of the population that organizations are required to take care of. In our situation, nearly 28% of our patients are covered under a state program, which would be Medicaid or IowaCare. If that program is substantially underfunded, which it is categorically, and we know on our IowaCare, for example, we've identified that we're paid about $50 million less than what the cost would be, particularly in the rate that we get no reimbursement for the physician side of IowaCare.
So as a CFO, how do you make up $50 million lacking in the funds?
Well, you have to transfer the cost to other payers is what happens, and that is a major challenge. I mean, as
people with health insurance, private health insurance.
We also need to understand that the University of Iowa gets no direct funding from the state, so there's no backstop to take care of that shortfall.
Joe LaValle of Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines, elaborate on what Kenneth Fisher is saying and the implications for your hospital center.
Well, I think the key here is for Iowa businesses and economic development leaders and policymakers to understand the implication on economic development. Excuse me. If you think about what we've just explained, that this cost gets shifted to private payers, it's a huge disadvantage to Iowa when we're competing for businesses. And the reason I say that is because it isn't true in every state. There are states in this country that make good money on Medicare. They actually get paid a great deal more.
For example, which states?
Well, Louisiana, New York, Florida, Texas, California. So, for example, for some procedures, it might be twice as much. You have your hip replaced in Des Moines. A year later, you have the other one done in another state. They might literally get twice as much money as we get for doing the exact same work.
How did they manage that?
Well, it's a combination, as was just explained, of the history of cost reports and all that. It's very technical, but it's also the politics. The big states have the votes in Congress, and they've been able to protect that advantage and watch it grow over the years. But the key point here is that if Iowa was paid the same on Medicare as those other states, or they were paid the same as Iowa, they wouldn't have that economic development advantage, because today New York hospitals can offer very deep discounts to their Blue Cross plan, to their other private payers, because they're subsidized by Medicare with this additional money. And in Iowa, it's just the opposite. We're underpaid by Medicare, so the private payers have to overpay us. Mm. And so if I'm a business trying to decide whether to locate in New York or Iowa, that's a factor that I know in Iowa I'm making up those premiums that are underpaid by Medicare.
Joe LaValle, we have to take a short break. Joe LaValle of Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines, Kenneth Fisher of the University of Iowa Healthcare with us, also Kirk Norris of the Iowa Hospital Association, talking today about the role of hospitals in our state economy, how that may be changed by healthcare reform, what's needed. We'd like your input as well. 1-866-780-9100. We'll be back in 1 minute. It's The Exchange. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, looking at the role of hospitals in our state economy, specifically with hospitals being a huge economic driver for many Iowa communities. Over 150,000 jobs in the state connected with Iowa's hospitals, over $1 billion as well. What is the economic development aspect of healthcare, possible healthcare reform in our state? Our guests, Kirk Norris, Joe LaValle, and Kenneth Fisher. Let's talk about IowaCare more in depth, since that was mentioned in the first segment of our program here. It's a program, for those not familiar with it, a program administered by the Iowa Department of Human Services. It serves Iowans on a predetermined qualifying income scale, those who can't afford health care otherwise. And currently, IowaCare patients must receive their health care either at Broadlawns in Des Moines, and that's open only to Polk County residents, I understand, or the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. So currently there is legislation moving through the Iowa House, drastically changing the IowaCare program. It extends IowaCare to community hospitals throughout the state. Okay, we'll get a correction on that. Perhaps you, Kenneth Fisher, can tell me what it does, the legislation proposing.
Well, the legislation that was adopted by the Senate yesterday does two major things. It broadens the coverage for primary care access to federally qualified health centers across the state.
What is the problem with only having it at Broadlawns and in Iowa City?
The practical problem is it restricts access to the services. There are approximately 120,000 people in the state of Iowa that qualify for the IowaCare program, greater than 100% of poverty up to 200% of poverty from an income perspective. There are currently about 35,000 covered lives in the program, and if I memory serves me correctly, it's something like 10,000 of those in Polk County, and then the balance of them throughout the rest of the state. So there is a large untapped potential of IowaCare patients throughout the state that currently do not have easy access to the program.
Aside from access, why is the University of Iowa Healthcare then backing this legislation? Why is this change needed now?
Well, the principal reason is that the IowaCare program waiver that's granted by the federal government will expire this summer. So it's necessary to extend and ask for a new waiver in order to extend the program, or it absolutely ends June the 30th of this year. A bit of history: when the program was created about 4 years ago, it was an extension of help me out there with the
Hawkeye program.
No, I'm drawing a blank on it, but there was the State Papers Program. I'm not from Iowa, so I have to call back these names. The State Papers Program, which covered about 4,500 people in the state. So by using those dollars that the state was funding to provide the State Papers Program, it was covering about 4,500 people. It leveraged those dollars then to be able to expand the program, and now it's gone from 4,500 covered lives to about 35,000 right now.
Kirk Dorris, tell us how you feel about this legislation being proposed.
Well, the Iowa Hospital Association always supports greater access to health care. And you really, to put some structure to this question, you first have for folks in Iowa that are have to go to the state for their insurance for economic reasons, you have the Medicaid program. And on top of that, and the Medicaid program is predominantly serves single mothers and children and then severely chronically disabled. In fact, the Medicaid program spends two-thirds of its money on one-third of its population, which is a severely chronically disabled, and then it spends one-third of its money on two-thirds of its population, which, again, are predominantly mothers and children. On top of that, years ago, the federal government provided incentives to expand to higher percentages of poverty-level state insurance programs, and that's when we created the Hawkeye program, which has been very successful. And the IowaCare's program, as Ken mentioned, is really an offshoot of the State Papers program, which was the program which historically provided allotments to all 99 counties to send patients to Iowa City for care of chronic and severe illnesses. And so you really have this three-tiered system, and the most recent legislation looks to expand upon that top tier. And so it sets up a structure where folks could get access to that program, but it also correspondingly requires that the state provide funding for that program. And at this time, at least we haven't moved through the appropriation process, if you just look at the budget process generally, it doesn't look as though the state's going to have the funding necessary to expand that state-sponsored insurance program to the outlines that they passed yesterday.
Joe LaValle, would you like to see IowaCare expanded to Mercy Medical Center, for example, in Des Moines?
Yes, but I think it's an even bigger issue for community hospitals across the state. We certainly do get IowaCare patients who come in our emergency department, for example, and they have this insurance card from the state, and we have to tell them, I'm sorry, but that isn't any good here. And obviously, we're willing to take care of those patients, and I think we lost between $1 and $2 million last year taking care of IowaCare patients who preferred to stay at Mercy. But again, I think it's less of an issue in Des Moines, where Broadlands is nearby, and if somebody wants to use their IowaCare card, they can go over to Broadlands and get good care over there. But if you think about Sioux City, Mason City, Council Bluffs, there are patients throughout the state that are a long ways away, and they're going in those community hospitals seeking care, and those community hospitals feel much, very strong obligation to take care of those patients, and they just get nothing. The state just pays them nothing for that care. So obviously we think that it makes sense to expand the program. One of the first steps that was suggested by the Iowa Hospital Association was to at least pay for the emergency department visit. As these people come into emergency departments and community hospitals, let's make sure the state of Iowa is at least paying the hospital for taking care of their emergency needs, stabilizing them, addressing anything urgent, and then if they need to be transferred, so be it, but at least pay the community hospitals for that first leg in the patient's journey.
Kirk Norris of the Iowa Hospital Association, how do you size up the chances of this legislation drastically changing the Iowa Care program in successfully getting through to become a change?
I think the legislature supports expanding care. It always becomes a cost question, and we know from surveying our members that emergency room care to folks that are currently enrolled in the Iowa Care program amounts to about $14 million statewide that the state's not paying for. And I think the Legislative Service Bureau has estimated that the cost of expanding the care that's outlined in the legislation that just passed is somewhere in the neighborhood of about $138 million. So in these tight budget times, it's not a question of folks really supporting greater access to care and the state's involvement in it. It's a question of where's the money going to come from. You know, when you talk about underfunding of Medicare and Medicaid, those two sources alone, which account for about 53% of hospitals' revenue statewide, underfund, now this is actual costs, underfund hospitals by about $277 million. And if you add uncompensated care at about another $300 million and charity care that's provided by hospitals under their charity care guidelines of about $400 million, you pretty quickly get right close to $1 billion in underfunded care that hospitals' first order of business is to try to figure out, you know, how to make that up.
Okay, Kirk Norris, we'll have to take a short break. Leaving us with that question, where's the money going to come from as we look at the role of hospitals in our economy and how that may be changed by health care reform and also the change in the Iowa Care program? If you'd like to join our conversation when we return in a few minutes, call now 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Back in a few minutes talking more about our economy and our hospitals. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, I talk with author David Schmid. His book, Natural Born Celebrities, looks at why serial killers like Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy, and John Wayne Gacy have become iconic figures in America. Then I'll talk with Iowa State University Professor Craig Anderson about new research on the effects of violent video games. Tune in tomorrow for The Exchange over the noon hour. Today, talking about the role of hospitals in our economy and how that may be changed by health care reform. Of course, health care reform, the final push taking place now, President Obama asking for that final push for some kind of comprehensive health care reform. Our guest today, as we talk about the economy and how hospitals fit into that in the state, we have with us Kenneth Fisher. He is Associate Vice President and CFO for the University of Iowa health care. Also, Kirk Norris, President and CEO of the Iowa Hospital Association. Joe LaValle, Senior Vice President of Planning and Advocacy at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. If you'd like to join our conversation, please do so. 1-866-780-9100. Your tough questions about or comments about how we get health care costs under control, how we improve health care in this country. 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you're a health care provider and you can provide an inside grassroots suggestion to what we're talking about. Also by email, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Let's jump on the idea of health care reform. President Obama making his last push for health care reform. I want to go around to each of you and ask, what would be the most important aspects for you of any health care reforms from a hospital's perspective? Let's start with Joe LaValle in Des Moines.
Well, one of the advantages to a large-scale health care reform bill is that specific fixes like the geographic disparity in payments could be included and certainly were proposed to be included in the bills that were being talked about. So when we talk about the political difficulty of getting fair payment for Iowa because of our lack of clout in the House of Representatives, one way to address that is to put it in a larger bill that has broader support from various parts of the country and constituencies. So we were hopeful in the health care reform bill that that issue would get addressed and we would get improved fairness in payment. And we also want to stress it's not just giving Iowa more money, but it's making sure that we stop overpaying the parts of the country that are wasting health care resources and unnecessarily utilizing care. And there's well-documented evidence that there are parts of this country where the economic engine is churning and they are using unreasonable levels of care, and we think some of those practices should stop. And so the payment reforms that were talked about in the bigger health care reform bill were all part of that, and we certainly supported that.
Now, it's surprising when I hear you say that, because a mantra we hear again and again in this health care debate is we don't want a one-size-fits-all solution. That's not American. That's not what it's about. But Joe LaValle, I just heard you say that the inequities are all over this place when we don't have a unified federal system.
Yeah, there's a big difference between the issue of one-size-fits-all and reasonableness in care. We certainly do, you know, doctors are scientists, and clinical trials and their work over time, they do develop best practices, clinical protocols that have been demonstrated to provide the best outcomes. And we certainly support reducing the variation in care and following best practices as a way to dramatically lower costs and improve quality. And we've done that here in Iowa. We certainly hope that your listeners understand that, comparatively speaking, Iowa has very low costs and very high quality in all of the studies that have been done comparing us to other states. And we're very proud of that work, but we're saying to places in the country that are overutilizing care and wasting resources that you should put that same rigor into the care that you provide. If we're going to solve the budget problem and reduce healthcare costs, certainly a big part of that solution has to be in the places where resources are being wasted.
Kirk Norris of the Iowa Hospital Association, what do you have to add to that, to the point of the most important aspects of healthcare reform?
Well, I think maybe just a point of emphasis. The Iowa Hospital Association has long advocated for nearly a decade now the need for Medicare to move to a value-based payment system. And by that, we mean rewarding care that's high quality and that it's efficient. And as Joel referred to, there are several studies, both from the federal government, from the Dartmouth Institute, from the Commonwealth Fund, that repeatedly place Iowa in the quartile where most other states don't exist, and that's very high quality, very low cost. You know, you started out your program talking about economic impact of hospitals and the importance of that. Here's another indicator. I mean, regardless of the economic sector you're talking about, if you had a sector that's performing very highly in terms of its efficiency and its quality, you have a good that's marketable. And yet we have a payment system in the Medicare system that doesn't reward that. We have hospitals in Iowa that work to reduce readmissions, have substantially lowered their readmission rate by 8 to 10% in just the last few years. We have our members in Iowa also are aggressive in terms of in the University of Iowa and Mercy are a couple of leaders in this regard. They're aggressive in pursuing process improvement techniques, whether it's with Lean or Baldrige initiatives or other quality initiatives. And they do that for two reasons. One, it raises their quality, their outcomes for their patients, and it also helps manage their expenses. And so when we look at federal reform, we really focus on those aspects of the reform. There's a lot of talk, and most of the public attention goes to other pieces of the legislation, but the reality of it is that private insurance trends the federal government in terms of how they pay. I've already said that Medicare and Medicaid make up over 53% of the revenues coming into hospitals in Iowa. Mm-hmm. That's a demographic that is somewhat consistent around the country, and so what we do with the federal payment insurance programs, whether it's Medicare or Medicaid, we'll see reflected with the private payers. And we really want to see those things in the health reform package so that we don't continue to have Iowans subsidizing the unnecessary utilization that we see in other parts of the country.
I have a number of callers to get to waiting to join our discussion. Before we do, I'd like to have Kenneth Fisher briefly address something that, Kenneth, you mentioned in the break, that really when we want to talk about, in the long term, helping reduce health care costs, we have to go to a root cause before people get sick and go to the hospital, social programs.
Well, that's fundamentally true. There's a very important hospital CEO in Boston named Paul Levy who writes a blog every day, and he reported in his blog yesterday that the fundamental difference between the United States and Germany, Canada, Netherlands, Sweden, and a few other major economically developed countries is that the combination of dollars that we spend as a percentage of our GDP on combination of social welfare and health care is almost identical. The difference is that in the United States, we spend about 2.5% of our GDP on social programs and the balance, 15 or 16%, on our healthcare system. Other countries spend maybe 9% on social programs and 9% on healthcare. So what they've done is they've understand and looked at the root causes of healthcare and tried to fix the problems by putting the infrastructure in place to ensure that people stay healthier longer.
So what, when we short a social program, we end up paying for it?
Absolutely.
Later on in terms of illness and showing up in our emergency rooms, for example.
That's an interesting one. But fundamentally, one of the things that, I mean, as we talked earlier, that the Medicaid program covers pregnant women and children. One of the things that has clearly been demonstrated is that if you can take care of a baby in the neonatal intensive care unit, that's very costly. But if you can take care of them and keep them out of the neonatal intensive care, there is a lot of substantial dollars that are saved to the system, both in the delivery and care of the baby, and then the long-term care of the child as they grow up.
Let's go to our callers. We have 10 or so minutes left. Let's get as many callers into our discussion as well. Ralph in Indianola, you've been listening to our discussion. What's on your mind?
Yes, good morning. Thanks for the
good afternoon.
Thanks to the experts here on this topic. When you folks start discussing billion-dollar numbers, you're about six orders of magnitude above where my old and tired mind can function.
All right.
Can I use an example here? I went through a simple procedure, a laparoscopic appendectomy, and I saw a piece of paper that maybe I shouldn't have seen that said that you folks considered the retail value of that, all of the services that were provided in the hospital, was worth about $10,000.
Mm.
But then I also read that the average payment by group insurance companies, private insurance companies, is about 43% of the retail value. Now, if that number is is pretty close, then we're talking about hospitals operating with at about 50% of their revenue at 43% of retail, and you just mentioned 31% of retail, I assume, for Medicare and Medicaid. So you've got a cash flow in a hospital which is keeping the place going at substantially less than the retail price.
How is, you're wondering how that's possible, how that works.
So if that's the case, then aren't we talking about Medicare and Medicaid being some two-thirds of where it needs to be and not 30% of where it needs to be?
Okay, let's see who wants to tackle that either. Joe or Kenneth? Joe?
Go ahead, Kirk.
Kirk, yeah, none of the above.
I think the caller is exactly right. The number that Joe gave earlier, and we try to be very clear in our publications, and we talk about costs, and the numbers that I gave you were cost numbers. The number that Joe was citing was a percent of charge, 33 cents on the dollar as a percent of the charge or the price that the caller talked about. And so he's right. Medicare and Medicaid are in that ballpark. The last survey that we did, Medicaid's paying about 65 cents on the dollar as a percent of cost. Medicare is actually better than that. Medicare's somewhere in the high 80% range in terms of a percent of cost that's reimbursed. So when he's looking at the price and the value equation, I think he's exactly thought through that correctly.
Kenneth, anything to add to that?
I was going to say that. I'll cite a couple of numbers from the University of Iowa. I believe the caller is referring to retail prices, what our posted prices are. The actual numbers at the University of Iowa is for every dollar we bill to somebody, we will actually average collecting about 43%, 44% of that. And our cost structure runs about 97% of that collected rate. So we're running at about 41% of the charges as how much our cost to run in total it works out to be. We currently have about a 2.6% operating margin.
Let's go to our next caller, Ed, joining us from Mount Pleasant. Hi, Ed.
Yeah, you spoke about problems in the House trying to get things done, but in the Senate, somehow if Grassley and Harkin, with their seniority, can't get something done with their committee chairmanships and some log rolling or something, I don't suppose it's ever going to get done, especially when they retire and we get younger people up there.
Oh, the earlier discussion about Iowa not having the political weight to change this
right.
Here. How is that possible with two senior senators that we don't have the political weight to do this?
You know, this is Joe LaValle. When Senator Grassley led the prescription drug bill, there was a partial fix to this problem in the prescription drug bill and was very much appreciated. And it's another example of how you, in order to get a fix for Iowa, you have to cloak it in a bigger issue that has broader support. But it was a partial fix, and these shortfalls are still very real. In fact, Iowa's entire congressional delegation, Senator Harkin, Senator Grassley, and all of the Congress people have been very supportive of this issue, have worked hard on it for years. But it's just on the Senate can do great things, but on the House side is where you run into the problem. And I do want to emphasize that the $26 million loss I cited earlier for Mercy on Medicare was against costs. So that's an actual loss against what it costs us to provide the care. And, you know, getting 80% of your costs might sound like a big number, but what business wants to take a 20% loss on what they do against their cost of doing business? So the challenge is very real. It's very big and politically very difficult to fix.
Kenneth Fisher, I don't know if we got from the University of Iowa Healthcare the figure on the losses due to Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement.
I didn't actually look at them before I came over, but I know that our Iowa Care loss is about $50 million, difference between our cost and what we get reimbursed. Medicaid, we come very close to breaking even, but it's because we get supplemental payments called disproportionate share payments that not every hospital gets, and that's because we have a much higher percentage of uninsured and low-insured patients, and the payment vehicle actually is the Medicaid program, even though that's not what it's there for. And on our inpatient Medicare, we make a little bit of money, but we lose probably 20% on our outpatient Medicare. So, it's all over the board as to who.
Very complicated to understand.
Yes.
A lot of variables, a lot of factors. Let's go to another caller, Ken. I believe Ken's calling from out of state, North Dakota. Ken?
Yes, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. What's on your mind, Ken?
I don't mean anything disrespectful to anybody right from the start here, but what I'm wondering is, like, you look at a hospital bill and you get two Tylenol and there's a $35-$40 charge for two Tylenol and such things, and I'm wondering how charges like that are justified.
Ken, thank you very much. Maybe to Kenneth for that.
It's a highly complex question, but I will try to answer it as fairly and honestly as I can. I'll use the University of Iowa as an example. In our particular environment, 85% of the inpatients who are admitted to our hospital are covered and paid for by some form of fixed payment. So it is not important at all what the charges are, because we're going to get paid based upon the diagnosis of that particular patient and the payment rate that's been established by the third-party insurance company. So the charges simply establish what the activity and the level of service that were provided to the patient, but do not reflect the actual payment that comes back to us.
Ken, does that make sense to you in North Dakota?
Kind of.
it would be like going to your car dealer and saying, you take care of me, and I have a flat tire, so I'm going to pay you $20 to take care of it. They may charge you $50, but you don't pay the difference because there's a contractual obligation, because your insurance company that you negotiated with to take care of your car repairs pays the $20 for you.
Oh, okay. I understand that then. Just one other question real quick, and I don't know if maybe...
Very, very quickly, Ken.
Okay, I don't know if the panel is it more controlling the cost of health insurance that we need to be after instead of the health care system?
Okay, thank you, Ken. Who wants to tackle that one?
Well, I'll tackle it. I mean, I think the issue in terms of costs comes right directly back to all of us. Increasing costs are a direct result of increased utilization. And there's a lot of things that hospitals can and are doing. There's a lot of things that the insurance industry can and should be doing in terms of greater collaboration with the provider community to manage chronically ill patients. Insurance industry has a wealth of data on and claims information on folks. And as was mentioned previously, there's good protocols in place for managing diabetic patients and other patients with chronic illnesses. And the insurance industry needs to be more forthright in terms of sharing that information and collaborating with providers so that we can better manage the patient and ultimately manage the utilization, which ultimately manages the cost.
Let me jump in here. I having been in this industry for a long time, I have had conversations with a number of physicians over the years. Diabetics, for example, should be treated in an outpatient setting. I had an endocrinologist tell me one time, we admit the system fails every time we put a diabetic patient in the hospital, because that disease can be managed very effectively in an outpatient environment. Sometimes we are not able to do it because the patient doesn't participate. And the incentives in our current system are not built around how do you help the patient be successful in managing their diseases.
So how do we change that?
Well, it's a tough question.
Want to take a crack?
One thing, you pay doctors and hospitals for managing care better.
Yeah, that's probably
We've had 80% reduction in readmissions for congestive heart failure patients. Mercy Clinics is doing all kinds of innovative things to keep chronically ill diabetics and other chronically ill patients out of the hospital. and nobody pays us for that. We reduce the utilization of the hospital. We reduce our revenues, and the insurance companies keep the difference. We need a system in which the payers reward providers for doing those things that manage care better.
Okay, incentivize that somehow.
The concept is called the medical home, which is right. built in. That's got to be built. Got to be built into the system.
Okay, I want to thank you all for joining us. Well, we've come to the end of our hour, and so many loose ends here that we did not tie up, but we did not expect them, because healthcare in our state, in our country, is a terribly complicated situation. But thank you for shedding some light on it this hour. Kenneth Fisher, Associate Vice President and CFO for the University of Iowa Healthcare. Also, Kirk Norris, President and CEO of the Iowa Hospital Association. Joe LaValle, Senior Vice President of Planning and Advocacy at Mercy Medical Center in Des Moines. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins. Our producer assistant today, Christina Sarnelli. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thank you for joining us.